WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Halloween is here. It's the one time of year that most of us give much thought to ghosts, and when we do, they are of the little variety that knock on the door and ask for candy. It's also the one time of year when children and adults can shed their normal skins and dress up in costumes that transform into everything from, well, these aforementioned ghosts to superheroes to monsters, ghouls, and other things that go bump in the night. In recent years, Halloween costumes and the donning of them have become the thing to do on this holiday. We're going to look at this phenomenon and the culture of Halloween later in the program. First, we focus on ghosts and not the ones walking the sidewalks tonight. Those that some believe are hanging around all the time. If you have a spectral friend, who are you going to call? This hour, it should probably be us because we've invited some actual Charlotte ghost hunters to join us. Jason Porter and Matt Owens are with the Carolina Paranormal Society. Jason is founder and director. Matt is general manager. They use scientific methods to detect and explain evidence of paranormal phenomena. Welcome, gentlemen. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
In case anybody, that's interesting. That microphone is not working. There we go. Now, good morning to you, Jim.
Thank you.
I've got it set up now. You describe your organization as not-for-profit, whose purpose is to research and investigate evidence of paranormal phenomena using practices and methods which are scientific in nature. And the goal is to prove whether or not ghosts exist is to gather and seek information on paranormal incidents to help you guys have a better understanding of ghosts and hauntings. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So how long has this been going on? Your involvement in this?
Well, I've been investigating the paranormal for 8 years. I'm started up in Maine, where I moved from. 4 years ago, I came down to the Charlotte area and started Carolina Paranormal Society.
Are there branches of this kind of activity going on all over the country? Because Maine is a fur piece from here, as we say.
Right. We're actually members of the TAPS family, which is the Atlantic Paranormal Society, the guys on Ghost Hunters. We actually have a network of groups throughout the country that investigate the paranormal, and we're just part of that network.
And how did you get involved, Matt?
I actually was attempting to start my own group here in Charlotte at the time that Jason moved here, and I met up with Jason, and I liked the mentality that he had. We shared a lot of the same viewpoints on the paranormal, and I decided to join Carolina Paranormal.
Do a lot of people talk about this, or are they reluctant to talk about this, either that they believe in ghosts or they are curious about whether or not they really exist?
I think that we've run into a lot of reluctance from some folks. It does vary, though. We'll find some folks who will come up to us on the street and say, hey, let me tell you about this experience I've had. Mm-hmm. And then we will run into some folks when they see us wear our hats or a shirt with our name on it. They'll avert their eyes and they kind of act like we might be weird or something.
Those people that do, I guess the people that call you, the people that are either experiencing what they believe to be paranormal activity or are curious about it, do they want you to find ghosts? Do they want these things to exist, or do they want them not? They want you not to find anything.
Most of the people that contact us are looking for validation. They've had many experiences in their home, and they want to know whether or not they do exist. So our first thing, we go in and we try to debunk or disprove the claims. And if we can't do that, we then try to capture activity on our equipment.
That's what a scientist does. They try to disprove
Correct.
Things. Is that the scientific method that you're talking about, or is there more to it than that?
Well, disproving first is part of it, but then we use various pieces of equipment, EMF detectors, which is electromagnetic field detectors. We use audio recorders. We use video cameras, different pieces of equipment, rather than using the psychics and those type of mediums to actually contact them.
Now, why is that? And you make that very clear in your literature that you use scientific methods and you don't use psychics, you don't do seances, as if to say those things are to be eschewed.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I can sit here in this room and say and come up with a story. And if you believe me, then, I mean, what kind of proof is that?
Mm-hmm.
Where if we have scientific methods and we're capturing actual evidence on video or audio, we've at least got something to somewhat prove it. Now, granted, they can be faked. That's why if you're looking at a paranormal team, you have to find someone that's reputable and make sure that they're not going out faking.
You want to see the raw video.
Right.
Not the edited video.
Exactly. And we do events, and we've got a couple pieces of audio that we faked just to prove that it can be done.
Right.
And, you know, everybody always at first is like, wow, that's awesome. And then we tell them it's fake. And they're like, oh, wow. But we make sure that we tell them that it's fake and to watch out for those bad groups out there that will fake evidence.
In your experience, either in this avocation that you have, because I think you have real jobs.
Yeah. I'm actually at my job right now. I have to go back afterwards.
So in your lifetime experience, including this job, have you found any evidence that ghosts exist, or do you call them ghosts?
We do call them ghosts. I personally feel like we have captured evidence that there is something, there is a life after death. There is something out there that precedes the living body. A lot of that evidence, I feel like it comes in the form of audio evidence. Some of the EVPs or electronic voice phenomenon that we've posted on our website. And I like those types of those pieces of proof, so to speak, because you're hearing a voice that's of someone that's not there that you've captured on audio.
Do you, when you're capturing these things on audio or when you're capturing images on video, do you see them? Do you hear them in real life, or do you only see and hear them when you play back the recordings?
With a true EVP, you're only hearing it when you go and play it back.
Why?
It's because it's being recorded on that medium, but you're not necessarily hearing it. Now, there is a phenomenon called AVP, which is audible voice phenomenon, that is actually a voice or sound that you hear while you're recording it as well.
Now, in the old days, when we all used tape, you could sometimes get ghost images, particularly audio ghost images, on the tape, things that were not on the track that you actually recorded, but that you could hear faintly in the background. And you could hear them because it was print through from a previous or a following layer of tape coming through and recording itself very faintly magnetically on the layer that you were listening to. That's not happening today because you don't use tape anymore, right?
That's correct. We use all digital audio equipment.
Okay.
So those...
So how does the microphone or the chip in the camera or the chip in the audio recorder pick up what you can't hear?
I believe it's because they're speaking into that equipment. They're close to it. We may not be able to hear that frequency with our own ears, but we can hear it when we go back and play it.
And what are they saying?
Can
you understand what they're saying? Or is it
absolutely.
Just a sound?
With the EVPs that we've captured, you can hear the voice just as clear as you and I talking here. But we didn't hear that at the time of the recording. So you go back and you listen to that, and sometimes they're answering questions. Sometimes they're saying a person's name. And
injecting into a conversation.
Absolutely.
When you hear these played back and you're hearing them say somebody's name, for instance, the power of suggestion is very strong. Have you heard? In other words, you talked to the people who've invited you to come, and you've done this interview with them to try to disprove it before you bring up all the equipment. Have they maybe told you this name, and you're predisposed to hear something like that?
Actually, no. I mean, I think Jason's captured names before, but none of the evidence that we have is on our website is name. What we're capturing is actually voices that sometimes are answering a question or even just saying something in general, Jason mentioned, interjecting themselves in a conversation.
Like, I actually caught one that finished one of our investigators' sentences. We were at Gold Hill, and she had thought she had seen an animal in the woods, and you can actually hear my investigator say it sounded like a coyote or a, and she was stumbling on her words. She couldn't think of it, and it finished her sentence and said fox, and it was a female voice of somebody that wasn't there, and you can clearly hear her say fox.
So is it the same volume level, the same?
It's usually a different volume level. It's usually a lot, it's lower. Mm-hmm. We've captured hundreds upon hundreds of EVPs, but our evidence standards are so high. There's different classes of EVPs. There's A, B, and C. A being like you and I talking now. B is more of a whisper.
And again, EVP means?
Electronic voice phenomenon.
So I don't know how to ask the questions for this kind of an interview. but if you have this equipment that is picking up things, things that aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
Does it necessarily mean that it's a spirit or a ghost, or could it be the internal thinking process of the person who actually said, I thought I heard a coyote or a, and they're thinking fox, but the word won't come out, but you're recording fox from her brainwaves. Is that possible?
I wouldn't think so.
What about images? Are you seeing images of things?
We have not captured anything as far as photo evidence. Now, we've captured a shadow on video that's moved across the room when there was no one in there.
And one of you has personal experience with this.
Both of us do.
Both of us do, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I've personally seen an apparition. I mean, this started for me when I was a child. I was staying over with a friend one night, and I saw what we assumed to be his grandmother in the bathroom mirror in the middle of the night.
You were washing your hands.
I was washing my hands, and this
looked up at the mirror.
Absolutely, and I saw a just as plain as looking at you here. I saw this older woman standing behind me in the mirror, and when I turned, she wasn't there, and during that time, there was no women in the house. It was just myself, my friend, and his father.
And I'm told that the father pulled you aside the next day to ask you a bunch of questions about this.
That's correct. He, that evening, of course, is middle of the night, so kind of dismissed it. But the next day, he said, you know, let me ask you what you saw, and actually took out a photo album and let me flip through it, and I pointed out the grandmother or his mother that had passed away in that home.
And you had never seen this person?
Never had seen her. She had passed away, actually, before I was born.
And he had seen her in the house?
He had.
He was looking for confirmation that he wasn't?
Absolutely. He had admitted to me then that he had had some experiences but had never told his son that.
Now, I read a bunch of stories about the two of you yesterday. Is that the story that when you saw the woman in the mirror, both of you were kind of startled?
Well, it was just me.
No, I mean the woman. It looked she was looking at you.
Yeah, she looked at me, and the reaction that I feel from looking at that was that she was like, "What are you doing here?" But you know, of course, I was 10 years old, so I was scared out of my mind.
You're just crazy.
That's it, Matt. we have yet to discover that. Matt Owens is the general manager. Jason Porter is the founder and director of something called the Carolina Paranormal Society. We're going to investigate this a little bit more as we go through the rest of this segment of the program. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlie's Soap, makers of hypoallergenic, biodegradable laundry, powder, liquid, and household cleaners made in North Carolina. Available at the Fresh Market and charliesoap.com. And Northeastern University, celebrating 1 year in Charlotte, hosting a graduate roundtable information session on November 14th for their 8 master's programs. Details at northeastern.edu/Charlotte. For a preview of what rising sea levels may do to our coastal cities, all you have to do is look at what happened in Manhattan during Hurricane Sandy. Battery Park flooded, countless subway tunnels did as well, and the 9/11 Memorial flooded. Due to climate change, this may become the norm as sea levels continue to rise. There's a lot of debate about how high they will rise, how fast it will happen, but at least one coastal geologist says current predictions are too optimistic. He joins us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Hurricane Sandy has disrupted lives up and down the East Coast. The storm's impact and possible effects on the outcome of the 2012 election.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking to Jason Porter and Matt Owens, both with Carolina Paranormal Society. You can go to their website, carolinaparanormal.com, and hear some of the recordings that we have been referencing in the first part of our conversation. I want to get something straight here for people who may be listening to this and going, come on, you guys are not Ghostbusters. You don't go in there and try to drive out ghosts from people's house. You don't perform exorcisms. You don't do cleansings. You don't do seances. So you just go in and record and investigate. Is that, take me through an investigation. I pick up the phone. I think I've seen something. I want to call you and ask you to come out. What happens next?
Okay. Well, when you submit a case request, we then call you back and we interview you. We've got an extensive interview questions that we go over. We then set up a date. We come out to your house and we listen to your claims of activity. We set up our equipment. We try to debunk your claims first.
What do you ask me?
We ask you everything from what kind of medication you're on, what kind of pets do you have. We have a large gambit of questions that we go through. And and then we ask what your claims are. And then we try to – in the meantime, before we get out there, we'll try to figure out what could it be. And then we'll actually look at it when we get there and try to figure out.
So then you set your equipment up.
Right.
If it leads to that, you set your equipment up and start recording and trying to find things. Is it possible that these things did in fact happen, that they are in fact paranormal, but you may not be there at the time when this paranormal activity decides to exert itself?
Correct. It happens all the time where we're not able to debunk, but yet we're not getting any evidence also, because sometimes you have to investigate a place 2, 3, up to 6 times before you even get anything. Put it this way, they're people. And just like people, some people are comfortable around strangers. Sometimes it takes 6 visits before they're comfortable around you. So that's the thing you got to remember, is they're people.
I know that you have a confidentiality policy with your clients, so right. I don't want you to get into details and attach them to people's homes or people in general, but specifically rather. But what kinds of events, what kinds of occurrences provoke people to call you?
Everything from items moving, noises in the house, like running up and down a hallway. We've got hearing voices, seeing apparitions. I mean, there's a huge amount of claims that come through.
Absolutely. And sometimes folks tell us that they've actually seen an apparition or shadows, and or they're hearing a voice, or they've even tried to capture their own evidence by setting out their own digital recorder, and they feel like they've captured something in their home. So they want us to come out and help validate or see if we can help find proof to what they've experienced.
Are most people simply curious, or are they frightened? Are they in fear of being injured or hurt in some way? What's going on here?
We've had a mixed bag of that, so to speak. We've had some folks that just really want us to come out and help validate. We've even had a couple of clients that just really wanted to see what we do and have the experience of an investigation. We've even had a couple of clients that have contacted us and said, until you come here and help look into what's going on in my home, I'm not stepping foot back in there.
All of us have heard noises that can't be explained, particularly in the middle of the night. All of us, I think, have seen shadows on the wall that can't be explained, or something passing by the corners of our eyes when there's no one there and there was no car on the street to make anything move, no glint of sunlight coming off a windshield casting a shadow on the wall or a headlight. We've all experienced that.
Right.
Would those all be paranormal phenomena?
No. And that is the type of thing that we go into, try to prove to the client that that's actually what's happening, that it could be a car passing by that's casting a shadow, or it could be something that's very explainable.
Do these phenomena tend to happen in older structures?
No, they can happen in brand new houses. The theories are that a ghost can attach themselves to a person, to an object, you know, like an old piece of antique or jewelry or something like that. I mean, you can go to a friend's house and one could follow you home. I mean, both of us have had something follow us home from an investigation.
Your job, really?
Yes.
Yes.
Not carrying anything with you, just following you home?
Just following us home, yeah.
You have, both of you have had lifelong experiences or brushes with paranormal phenomena. Does that predispose you to find things, perhaps, that somebody who has not had that but has the same equipment would not find?
I don't necessarily believe so. In saying that, he and I are not sensitive or anything in any way to the paranormal, so to speak. We're not psychic or anything like that. And I don't think that just the experience predisposes us to having experiences. I think anyone can have that. I think it's the approach that we take, that we actually don't look at everything as paranormal. You know, we look for that reasonable explanation. And keep in mind that 90% of the cases that we do, we are able to disprove the activity that the client claims. It's only in that 10 or less percent that we go to that we may find or document something that's paranormal.
Yeah, I want to reiterate that. You have received 98 case requests this year, by your accounting, and investigated only 25. I guess that means the rest of them didn't meet the criteria to be investigated.
Well, lots of times we'll get someone that sends in a case request, and they either never call us back. Mm-hmm. I mean, we always make 3 attempts to call them back. They'll schedule an investigation and then cancel for some reason.
Mm-hmm. We're able to help some on the phone as well,
right,
with their activity.
So you investigated this year about 25% of the cases,
right,
that came to your attention, but you have disproved 90% of the cases that you have investigated. That leaves you with only 10% that shows some kind of unexplained activity.
Right.
What does that say to you guys who do this all the time?
To me, it says that a lot of people are watching paranormal shows, and you know,
I was going to get to that, because there are guys on television. There are whole television series that deal with guys who do precisely, well, not precisely, perhaps, but appear to do precisely what you do. Does that influence people? Does that predispose people to hearing things and seeing things that really aren't happening, but they think they're happening because they just finished watching this show on television and it scared the dickens out of them? Well, they thought it was funny, but nonetheless, it opened their mind up to something.
Right. We get that all the time. You know, it's really for us, it's been really hard for us to get these cases and go out to them and have them say they watch all the shows, and we start rolling our eyes
because these shows are very, they solve the problem in 60 minutes or 30 minutes if there's a 30 minute, but they also, I've watched one or two of these, and they set it up and they, oh, did you hear that? They're very dramatic,
yeah,
about,
right,
this. which makes you want to watch because I didn't hear that. Maybe they heard something I didn't hear. You know, that's what they're trying to do. Right. You don't do that?
No.
How do you differ from if you come to my house to do exactly what these guys on TV are trying to do? Do you do it in the middle of the night like they do?
Yes.
In the dark?
We do it in the dark. Cameras.
I think that is a big misconception over what we do because it is dramatized on television. We operate very similar to what you would see, say, on Ghost Hunters on television, but they use those dramatic sequences and some music sometimes to build that for television, where, in fact, when we've had investigators come to our team and think that it's like that we're going to wrap up something in one night, they find out how much really hard work mm-hmm. it is. There's many, many hours behind the scenes. And the thing with the TV shows, too, what you don't see is all the stuff they've edited out over. It takes them weeks sometimes to do some of these cases and go through everything. But, of course, they edit out all the hard work to pack it into an hour-long television show.
You've had these experiences, these encounters your whole lives, and now you do this at the request of other people, and you've added equipment over the years. Back in the early days, I'm sure you didn't have any equipment. In your experience, when you encounter an apparition or something that levitates an object and moves it or something like that, do you actually see the object levitating? Do you actually see? One of you has a story of a trash can lid going up and down, up and down, up and down.
Yeah, that actually occurred in my own home that I own now, and this kind of goes back.
No rodent in the trash can?
No cat
in the trash can?
No, sir. And this goes back to what we were saying, that sometimes they follow you home. When I bought my home 7 years ago, there was no activity there whatsoever. And then I got into investigating the paranormal full-time with this group, and as I did that, I've had a huge increase of paranormal activity in my home. And as the example with the trash can, you know, I'm sitting watching NASCAR one afternoon, and there was actually nothing in the trash can, no bag, no trash, nothing. And I actually watched the lid levitate.
How high?
It was about 2 to 3 feet off of the top of the trash can, and it set perfectly back down. And this happened three times.
I just want to know how deeply into the race you were and how many beers you'd had.
That's a good question, but in this particular instance, I hadn't cracked open the first beer yet.
Okay.
The race had just started.
Okay. In your experience, when you encounter these things, what do they want? What are they aware of you? Are they aware of those around you? Do they have an agenda?
If it's an intelligent haunt, which means it's communicative, it's looking to make communication, it make contact. It's all it's trying to do is to prove to you that it's there. And it will do things like levitate trash can lids, move something. You know, if you put your keys down on the table and now all of a sudden they're on the counter, most people just say, oh, well, yeah, I thought I did that, but I guess I didn't. That could be something, you know, if that happens all the time, that could be something where it's saying, hey, look, I'm actually moving this item.
How many of them are malicious? How many of them are just doing things that we find, disturbing because it's happening and we're not doing it?
I've never come across one.
I haven't either.
So we shouldn't be afraid of these things.
No. They're people.
Yeah. And I think that's also a misconception, is that folks think that it's something evil or out to get them. And my personal belief is that the ghosts are people and they're trying to communicate. They realize that, and particularly in our case, we're going out trying to communicate with them. So I feel like they are trying to communicate back because that's, you know, they see us there saying, hey.
What's the most profound thing any of these entities have ever communicated, in your opinion?
Oh,
Has there been anything profound? I mean, has it been a case where they're trying to communicate to the owners of the home something that would be important or would resolve a situation, and that's happened?
We've never had anything like that. We've had, you know, we've found out names. They are? I mean, that type of thing.
Does this happen more often? Do you get more calls at this time of year?
Absolutely, Absolutely. I mean, people are thinking about it. Wintertime is usually, well, springtime is usually the busier time because you've been inside all winter. So
cabin fever.
Cabin fever. People get, you know, they start to see it more.
You can find out more about this group because it's not just these two guys. There's 21 of you, I think, involved in this area. Jason Porter is the founder and director, and Matt Owens is the general manager of the Carolina Paranormal Society at carolinaparanormal.com. Go check out the Ghost in the McGlone Theater down the hall while you're here. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, children have dressed up in costumes on Halloween for years. A costume is a must if you want to go trick-or-treating. But in recent years, this phenomenon has spread to adults, and not just at Halloween costume parties. Some adults even conduct business in costume on Halloween, so much so that Halloween has become big business itself in America, with costumes at the heart of the economics of the holiday. So what is this all about? What has given rise to the culture of Halloween in modern American society? We spend the rest of the program investigating that with Leslie Bannatyne, an American author who writes extensively on Halloween, its history, its literature, and how we celebrate or observe it today. Her most recent book is Halloween Nation, Behind the Scenes of America's Fright Night. She's shared her knowledge of the day on TV specials for Nickelodeon and the History Channel, and does so with us as she joins us now by phone from Boston. How are you? How did you fare in the storm, Leslie?
Oh, hello. Happy Halloween. Boston escaped with, compared to New York and New Jersey, minor damage, but still, it's a mess out there. It's mostly trees down, power lines down, and we're on the coast, so a lot of boats are where they shouldn't be.
Well, we'll talk about Halloween and not the storm, although the storm was scary
enough.
Thomas Cole is an historian and adjunct faculty member of the History Department at UNC Charlotte, whose interest in Halloween stems mostly from studying American religion and culture. Thank you for being with us today. And Scott Morris is also here. He's the president of Morris Costumes. I'm going to say one of the largest suppliers, but I believe it is the largest supplier of costumes in the world. Is that right?
That is correct.
It has been based here in Charlotte for over 50 years, and that makes us the epicenter of Halloween. Thank you for being here. I haunt your location on many occasions. As a child, I remember dressing up for Halloween, but I remember only kids dressing up for Halloween. There was a rare party where adults would do so, but in recent years, it seems that more and more adults are involved in this costume phenomenon. They wear them to work. They have major parties. One radio station in the area held this big block party down the street from where we're sitting right now last Saturday night. It was enormous. There must have been several thousand people there in costume, and they probably all came from your store.
I hope so.
are most of the costumes that you rent for Halloween or sell for Halloween for adults?
There's adults and kids both, without a question.
But have you seen a rise in
adults? But we have seen a huge rise into the adults over the years. And I think that becomes from kind of the history of Halloween. And when I was a kid, Halloween was really a kid's holiday at that time. We traveled the neighborhood getting the candy and having kids' parties and doing all the fun things that you would do as a kid. And as you grew up with it over the years, then you took it into your adulthood.
Is it just our generation, the baby boomer generation, who grew up on Wizard of Oz and Peter Pan and who refused to grow up, that have made this Halloween phenomenon grow and grow and grow into adulthood?
Yeah, I think that's a good hypothesis. Leslie can confirm this, but I have it in my notes that in 1990, adult costumes began to overtake children's costumes in the sale of that. That's the watershed year.
Leslie, I'm going to get a comment from you on this, but I have to take a break. So when we come back, I'll get your take on what's behind this and how long it's been going on, this growth in the popularity and, more importantly, the participation in all things Halloween. We're taking a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat, whose sleep doctors offer treatment for insomnia, sleep apnea, snoring, narcolepsy, and more. Details at goodsenses.com. Hurricane Sandy has disrupted lives up and down the East Coast. Diane Rehm and her guest will talk about the storm's impact and possible effects on the 2012 presidential election in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We're going to continue our conversation about Halloween. Specifically this time around about Halloween culture, costumes, and the like in just a moment. Stay with us.
Patrick George, owner of Heartwood Tree Service in Charlotte, a WFAE underwriter.
If your business is more than just a commodity, then you're going to find people that are searching for quality. You know, I am absolutely proud to be a supporter of the information that goes out to the community and to the asset that it is to our community.
Underwriting on WFAE says a lot about your business. For more information, email underwriting@wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about the culture of Halloween in this segment, and particularly the rise of the adult participation through costumes and other things, with Thomas Cole, who's an historian at UNC Charlotte, Scott Morris, president of Morris Costumes, and Leslie Bannatyne, author of Halloween Nation, Behind the Scenes of America's Fright Night, and many other books and pieces about Halloween over the years. What is going on here, Leslie, this increased adult participation in this holiday?
Well, I think we're on the right track in that baby boomers who were trick-or-treating back in the 50s and 60s just don't want to give it up. And actually, they don't have to anymore. I mean, that's what's changed.
What's wrong with us? Our parents grew up.
It's part nostalgia, what we're seeing now for that. You know, there's nothing like running around in a cape, you know, with a tail after dark getting candy. And somehow we just can't give up that feeling of freedom and absolute license. But it's also, Halloween's become more of a horror holiday ever since maybe the 1978 John Carpenter Halloween movie that set it on Halloween, named it Halloween, and had Halloween as a plot point. We've come to see Halloween the holiday and Halloween the horror film is kind of similar, and horror has a huge number of people who love it, and those people now have taken Halloween as their holiday, as have a lot of other alternative cultures, because Halloween doesn't celebrate any one specific thing like a Christmas, Easter, or Thanksgiving. It's up for grabs, and so, you know, goth culture, metal culture, lots of different alternative subcultures have grabbed Halloween, and it's become a huge adult holiday.
And is it also because most of us, not all of us, live fairly buttoned-down lives? This is the one moment in the entire year where we literally can either shed our skins or adopt a covering for our skins that allows us to be whatever we want to be, Thomas?
Absolutely. I would say absolutely. I mean, we used to dress up on a lot of different holidays. We used to have masquerade balls. Mm-hmm. And now, unless you're lucky enough to live in New Orleans, Halloween is what we've got left.
Or Venice. Thomas?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I found a story from the Charlotte Observer in 1915 reporting that 8 young women had been arrested after their participation in the Halloween parade in Asheville because they had worn men's clothes. The judge let them off for a year on the condition that they not be seen wearing men's clothes during that year.
You know, the other thing that strikes me as odd is we live in a culture of fear. I really do believe that we live in a culture of fear. We're scared of our own shadows, and part of that's because of the media. You turn on the local news, and you'd think the whole world has gone to hell, and that you better not go outside the door after dark because you will be killed on the first step down from the front door. And yet on Halloween, we open the door to strangers who are wearing masks and who are telling us, give me something or I'm going to trash the front of your house. What is that all about? Seriously.
There's a long tradition in other holidays of going door to door and begging. I think
Christmas.
Christmas, yeah.
Yes, Christmas prior to Charles Dickens was about that.
Right. I think it has something to do with social role reversal of or just the making a demand on those in power and exercising a little power over them just for one night.
Also, it's like a roller coaster. You know it's fake. You know, it's scary. It's a haunted house, but you know it's not real. And yet you still get the same adrenaline rush that you might if it were a real situation. It's just that your brain kicks in immediately and says, nope, this is fake. This is fun. At Halloween, you put your arms around the darkness, and it's your call. You know, you're in control on Halloween, whereas a lot of other times, I think you're right, we're just not in control.
What are people looking for when they come to Morris Costumes for Halloween party? And is there a difference between what kids want and what their parents want if they have an opportunity to get all dressed up?
Oh, I think so. I think the kids, a lot of times the parents have a preconceived idea of what they want their kids to be. And some of the kids
like what? Princesses and Superman?
Yes, yes. And the kids want to be whatever they want to be. That's their one opportunity to do what they want to do. And
I know you rent Superman costumes.
Oh, yes.
And you rent Batman costumes.
We have 24,000 different costumes.
Does anybody ever rent a Robin costume?
Sure.
People want to be Robin? They're not Batman?
Robin. Fred Flintstone and Wilma and Barney.
Well, that I understand. Yeah, they're equals.
Well, Barney's not really equal to
that's
Fred.
That's true.
But the lesser characters are always bought or rented, but just not quite as often.
Are there more adults renting or trying to put together? Because not everybody rents. They buy pieces and put them together themselves. Are they more interested in scary, ghosty, ghouly things, monster things, or do they want to go out as Prince Valiant?
I think over the years it has changed. In the early years, it was the ghost, and it was the old-time characters that want to be a vampire or a werewolf mm-hmm. or whatever. But there's so many different characters out there today and so many different ideas. People are making up their own costumes, buying the accessories.
And we have these TV shows about vampires and movies about vampires and TV shows about zombies. Has that created a rush on that particular kind of costume?
Without a question. Twilight and the Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. Zombies are huge this year. Twilight's been huge for the last four or five years. Mm-hmm. And simple things such as fangs, the sale of fangs have quadrupled over the last 5 years.
Leslie, your writing specializes on folklore and popular culture, and you've done, as I said, a number of books on Halloween. You've done TV specials, etc. As compared to Christmas and other holidays, where does Halloween fall in the ranking of popular holidays in America?
Oh, gosh, it depends on who you're talking to. With children, you know, it might be up there on the top three.
Is that because they get to dress up or because they get candy?
Oh, both those things. Both of them. You know, up there with birthdays and Christmas. I think as far as popularity, in the past 10 years, it's just grown so popular that I think it goes, you know, for the many of us, it goes Christmas, Halloween, and then you know your next favorite holiday. I mean, what's that?
Thanksgiving, for crying out loud. There's food. And that's another thing. A lot of the really popular holidays seem to occur in the fall. Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas is kind of the tail end of the fall, beginning middle of winter, I suppose. But not so much in the summer and spring. Is that because we have other things to put our minds on?
Well, it has to do with the roots of these holidays in agricultural societies, I imagine, that harvest time, work's done, and you can pursue other things for a while. Mm-hmm. Or celebrate the harvest is complete.
And yes, and it's the first time in many years gone by that you would have roasted meat, and it would be fresh. And so that was definitely an occasion for a feast.
And I suppose, talk to me about the Halloween jack-o'-lantern. Did that come about because it's harvest time for pumpkins?
Oh, absolutely. If there weren't pumpkins, there wouldn't be jack-o'-lanterns, that's for sure. But it was originally a trick that kids played, in our country at least. In the early 1800s, they'd find a leftover pumpkin because they were everywhere. You know, we used them to feed cows and make pies and do everything. Carve them out, put a face in them, put a candle in them, hang them on the end of a stick, and float them in front of the window of an unsuspecting neighbor, or pop them out from behind a a wall and scare people to death. It was a trick. It was called the pumpkin trick. And because words jack-o'-lantern used to refer to an elusive light, they became known, this pumpkin trick became known as the jack-o'-lantern because it appeared and then it disappeared and you never know who did it or where they came from. And it only became, you know, plopped on a porch when hostesses started throwing Halloween parties in the late Victorian ages and used them as decorations.
A lot of religious believers don't like this holiday because they feel it's an observance that glorifies the devil or, you know, the spirit world, which is not something that they want to talk about. Why is this Halloween on the calendar in Judeo-Christian countries? You're the religious expert here, Thomas.
All right, thanks. Well, the next day is All Saints Day, and what holier day than that is when it's the date of not just one saint, but all the saints.
Halloween is All Hallows' Eve.
Exactly.
Which means what?
The evening before the day for all the Hallows, hallowed being the holy ones, the saints. So, for instance, on this day in 1517, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral, saying this is how I propose reforming the church. And didn't occur to me until today that he probably did that because he knew that everybody would be at the church the next day for.
So that's kind of the ultimate trick or treat, isn't it?
That's right.
To nail your demands on the church door in that period of
and
time.
To make sure people would see it. Yeah.
How did it morph Halloween, All Hallows Eve, from this religious calendar moment to the black cat, the carved pumpkin, the handouts of candy, the costume party that it has become?
Well, it morphed because it took older pagan traditions merged with it, that it was trying to displace them, but it ended, the two ended up running together. Leslie says a lot about that in her book.
There's, Scotland was Protestant, and, we were just talking about Martin Luther, that it was Calvinist. So in Ireland, for example, All Saints Day existed just fine with earlier incarnations of spooky holidays like Samhain or Summer's End. But in Scotland, where you couldn't be a Catholic anymore, and you couldn't have an All Saints Day, ghosts were sleights of Satan, you know, all this stuff was taboo. But the practices in the instincts of the people just don't go away. They just kind of migrate out a little bit into folklore. And so you start seeing in Scottish poetry and literature in the 1500s, as early as that, Halloween as a night for the witches.
Mm.
Witches and cats. And it starts to become this beautiful, dark image that plays throughout poetry and literature
to this day. Back in those days, were those things considered taboo and scary, as opposed to today we look at black cats and jack-o'-lanterns and witches on broomsticks and kind of laugh at them?
Definitely. I mean, people believe there were witches. In Scotland, they put about 3,000 people to death for the crime of witchcraft. It was definitely very much on their minds. And cats have been domesticated, and they've kind of been exonerated as an evil beast, but bats are still a little bit scary.
We don't have pet bats. Why black cats? It wasn't the tabby cat that was immortalized
right.
by Halloween. It was the black cat. Why?
The black cat. Well, nocturnal, the nighttime. This is a night holiday.
Ah.
So dark creatures get associated with it.
You talked about domesticating the cat. This is one of those holidays, Thomas, that has been domesticated because it wasn't always as...
Oh, it's been tamed.
Smooth, yes.
Yeah, it was wilder and more dangerous, I suppose, in pagan times. And then it became associated with social gatherings and frolics for young people. And then also it's always had this theme of pranking, people putting on costumes so that they could commit some petty vandalism, sometimes not so petty, or frighten people, as we heard. And the costumes let them blame it on the spirits who are thought to walk abroad that night.
Well, since it started as this, it's kind of hearkening back to paganism at a time when the world was very strictly, structurally Christian, the Western world. How did suddenly these taboo things like dressing up and laughing at witches as opposed to burning them at the stake, how did that happen? How did we make that transmission or that transformation?
You have in the public library, it's some letters of J.B. Ivey, the department store owner, who was a really upright Methodist pillar of the church. And in one of the letters, he's saying, went to the Halloween party, saw the young people in their gay costumes, and he was had no problem with it. I think in his time and his place, he was certain about the centrality of Christianity in American culture. Mm-hmm. So he didn't see these evocation of pagan things as any kind of threat. And however, I think we live in a more diverse world now, and so people aren't so sure of that centrality anymore.
Is it just the Western world, Leslie, that celebrates this holiday? Is it just the European, American world that does this? And I guess South America, because they really do get into this in a very different way.
You know, now many people celebrate Halloween, but it is an American product that's kind of been exported through our movies and our television shows and our merchandise. So that you see, for example, a Halloween-themed amusement park in China called the Halloween Bash at Ocean Park, or you see in Japan or Ukraine people dancing the Thriller dance in Halloween parades. I mean, it has started to go global.
Speaking of paraphernalia and merchandise, Morris Costumes, I didn't know this, but you have 300,000 square feet of warehouse on 70 acres. How did it become so big? You really are the supplier of costumes to North America and possibly the world, even bigger than Hollywood.
We truly are. We started the business when I was a kid in the basement of our home. My dad produced shows and circuses. I actually had a show on WBT and a Friday night horror show, Dr. Evil's Horror Theater.
WBTV.
WBTV.
Yeah.
Don't know if you remember that or not.
No, I wouldn't hear
but,
that.
And he took the costumes off the shows and put them in the basement of our home. And my mom would rent them out at Halloween time to the neighbors. Very, very small home, and it was for something for her to do as my dad traveled 45, 50 weeks of the year. And the business grew, and they finally opened a small retail store. And then one day, this gentleman out in Arizona called my dad and said, look, I made some masks and wanted to know if you wanted to sell some of these masks.
Speaking of masks, during presidential election years, and we only have 30 seconds here, they usually rent masks or sell masks of the candidates. Can you tell from the number of people renting candidate X versus candidate Y who was going to win the election?
No.
Darn.
No.
Because I was going to ask you what you're renting more of here.
But it's running 47-53 right now.
What are you going out as tonight, Leslie?
I go classic. I'll be a witch.
Okay. Thomas?
I'll be home doling out the candy.
And Scott, do you even put a costume on?
I'm a zombie this time of the year.
Just overwork. Scott Morris, president of Morris Costumes, Thomas Cole, historian at UNC Charlotte, and Leslie Bannatyne, author of Halloween Nation, Behind the Scenes of America's Fright Night, among other books. Thank you all.